I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. There's a particular food problem in this country, and it's not a lack of it, at least not when it comes to meat and dairy. A perfect storm of circumstances has left producers scrambling to find adequate cold storage for beef, pork, and chicken products, as well as for surplus milk and cheese. Today, a look at the factors that led to this predicament. Will farmers and ranchers take a hit, or will they be able to respond quickly enough, and who could benefit from this dilemma? Then, why a conference designed to bring America's women together back in 1977 caused a political divide still being felt today. Hear about the issues that pitted conservative women against feminists then and now. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Meat and dairy are piling up across the U.S. Cold storage sites are packed to the rafters, and the federal government, which subsidizes the ag industry, is looking for ways to alleviate the problem, at least in the short term. A combination of factors have led to this: increased production, flat demand despite near-record consumption of milk and cheese, and trade issues. And in the long run, it's unclear whether market forces will get production back in line with demand. One beneficiary, food banks, which are getting unexpected donations of milk and meat. With us, Jonathan Aull is a Missouri reporter for Harvest Public Media who's written about this. He joins us from Rolla. Jonathan, nice to have you.
Thanks, Steve. A pleasure to be with you.
Bill Lapp is president of Advanced Economic Solutions in Omaha. He has over 30 years of experience analyzing and forecasting economic conditions and commodity markets. Bill, good morning to you.
Well, good morning. It's great to be on the show.
Jonathan, you know, one of the people you interviewed for your article described what's going on right now as a perfect storm, and that's why cold storage facilities are nearly filled to the rafters. Explain to us, what is going on out there?
Well, there's a lot of things going on. I think the first thing to keep in mind is that production of meat and dairy is just getting more efficient. As we move more and more towards larger factory-type production, things that are more concentrated, things that are more business and less small independent producers and more consolidation, it's just getting a lot more efficient. So for less money, meat and dairy producers are able to produce more than they've ever been able to produce before. So that's the first fact. The second fact is that the demand, you know, it hit a high maybe about 10 years ago, and then it really hit the skids, and now it's slowly getting back up. A lot of that was the recession. You know, for a lot of people, when their paychecks are lower or gone, or they're trying to make ends meet, instead of buying steak, you buy noodles. And, you know, that's one of the first changes that you can make to try to get your budget turned around while still feeding your family. So that was one of the issues that was going on as well. Other people also debate whether, you know, the changing flavors and tastes of people, you know, as they're thinking about how they eat and what they eat and how that might be decreasing some meat and dairy demand as well. So you got production that's way up, and you got demand that's flat to down to slowly rebounding. And then the other issue here is trade. With the new tariffs that are coming up, the export markets for a lot of this food and in terms of milk and drink, they're high tariffs on it, and some of the export markets have dried up. So there's another way where the demand is going down. The other thing to keep in mind is that with a lot of this kind of thing, with this kind of production, it's really hard to stop midstream. If you're making widgets or shirts or something like that, it's a lot easier to say, we're just not going to run the factory today. But when you're talking about living organisms that, you know, cows that have to be milked and pigs that are growing, and they, when they get to a certain age, to slaughter them, or you have to do something with them, you can't really adjust the demand on a dime the way that you can in other manufacturing. So if you add all of these things together, essentially there's a lot of meat and cheese and milk out there, and and they're having a hard time of what to do with it.
So as a result, these cold storage facilities are being filled all the way up to the roofs, it sounds like. Bill Lapp, how unusual is it to see cold storage capacities being reached across the country?
Well, a couple things. There's a seasonal factor. So you're going to see pork bellies, which we make into bacon reach peak levels early in the spring, anticipating the summer season, you know, before the holiday season in the basketball tournaments. You know, you see wing inventories pick up, and then they are offloaded and consumers use them. So there's a little bit of a seasonality factor in there. I would say that we're off of record levels. We reached record levels in beef, pork, and chicken a couple of years ago. Cheese inventories are extremely large, and you know, I guess the thing I'll mention here is that there are two things you can do when you have more product than you were able to sell yesterday, and one is to try and discount the price and send it to the grocery store and have them clear more meat through the market, or put it into storage for hopes that there's a you'll incur some costs there, but that there'll be a higher price later on. And that those both are the function of prices. I tend to think that the amount of meat we have in cold storage is a reflection of what the dynamics are in the market and not the thing that causes them.
What do you think, Bill, is the right way to go right now? Is it discounting the price? Is it selling them to supermarkets? Or is it putting it into storage?
For a majority of the time, it's to find a lower price. So there's a lot of anticipation. As Jonathan mentioned, you know, the meat factory keeps moving meat into the system, and we have an idea, and people like myself are expected to try to predict based upon some factors what that supply will be going forward. So you would contact your customers, the grocery stores or food service outlets, and say, we have a surplus of this. Can you utilize this if we discount the price? And then a small share of that will go into inventory if it reaches a low enough level.
Mm-hmm. This notion of cold storage being filled up, Bill, this happens from time to time in the industry. Nothing unusual with that, right?
Yes. And like I said, there's seasonality of different items that go into cold storage at different times of the year. So anybody who operates a cold storage facility knows that there's going to be certain times that certain pork products or beef products or chicken products are going to be larger in that and be a larger share of the total supply. You know, we're at high levels on certainly on beef and pork, and maybe a little bit less so on chicken right now, but it's not unusual to see surges of inventory levels when prices reach a low enough level.
Yeah. Jonathan, what happens if we run out of cold storage for all this dairy and meat being produced out in farm country? What's the consequence? What happens then?
Well, that's a great question. Where does it go? And, you know, the cold storage industry, definitely they're talking about being, you know, at functional capacity. Now, they certainly have a little bit of wiggle room in there, you know, because there's not a single day at a cold storage facility where something isn't leaving the building. So, you know, even when you are at capacity, you can, you know, kind of fudge it a little bit and move some stuff around and kind of make it up. But yeah, eventually what could conceivably happen would be that that there would just be nowhere to put it, and the producers have to figure out what to do with it. The other issue in the cold storage industry that the industry spokespeople told me about was that right now the margin on cold storage is tight enough that nobody wants to build new unless they have a long-term contract. So a short-term problem is not going to be resolved by the cold storage industry building more. And some companies are actually building their own on-site cold storage, which, you know, if they're willing to foot the bill for that, that might be a short-term solution. But yeah, it's a good question. I think that, you know, the food banks have definitely benefited from this. I think consumers will benefit, as Bill said, with lower prices. But yeah, it's something that unless something changes, the dam's going to burst not too long from now.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about meat and dairy products sort of piling up across the country, cold storage sites reaching capacity, and what this means for consumers out there. You know, Bill, what does this mean for the average consumer? Why should the average consumer care about these ever-changing dynamics out here?
Well, it's a benefit. You're paying a smaller share of your paycheck for these items, so that's a pretty big benefit. We reached, on a per capita basis, record levels before the recession in 2007 and saw about a 10% decline in consumption of all meat products, and now a 10% rebound back to those record levels. So the fact that the producers of meat out there continue to increase each year, it's been a benefit, and it's created a decline pretty steadily over the past 5 to 7 years in the retail price of these meat products. So beef would be an exception, but that's turned around here in the last 2 or 3 years, and things are not quite as expensive as they once were.
Tell us a little more, Jonathan, about the cyclical nature of food production. I mean, why do things ebb and flow as much as they do?
Well, I mean, remember that, like, bringing a hog, and hogs are maybe not the greatest example because they actually live shorter. Cows live a long time, relatively, and it's not like you can say, I want to increase meat production tomorrow, so we're going to birth new calves. I mean, you have to go through the whole cycle of when is it season to breed, and when are they the calves going to be ready, and you move them along, and you move along the process. So it can take a fair amount of time. So even if today the beef industry collectively decided that they were going to reduce production, it would take them months and months and months to really be able to do that, just based on the number of animals that they have in the growth process and in the pipeline so far. So it's not something that can change that quickly. Chicken has a lot more flexibility because chickens don't live as long, and they go from birth to be ready to slaughter in a much tighter window. Hogs, even less so, or more, they're in between. But so beef has the least amount of flexibility. So that's why the long-term forecast on this is really, really critical. And at least the economist that I talked to that works for a lot of the meat industry, they think they're making money, maybe not universally with all of the meat products. That's the other thing. We talk about meat products like it's this big monolith, but really there's so many little different bits and pieces. You know, even in beef, there's high-end beef and lower-end beef, and there's different sectors in the beef universe. So they see that they're still making money overall, and they're making money in some sectors, so they're very reluctant to start talking about cutting production, and I think they can kind of wait this out, especially with tariffs being this big question mark, because conceivably tariffs could change very quickly. The other thing is that, you know, international trade is so funny. Hogs were hurting, and then we have this swine fever in China, and even with the huge tariff that the United States has on American pork right now, China started buying a lot more than they had been since the tariffs started. So, you know, a lot of it's a gamble and it's a crapshoot. And ultimately, as long as the producers are making money, they're probably not going to change that much that quickly.
Bill, I can't help but wonder about the changing tastes of American consumers when it comes to things like steak and when it comes to dairy products. You hear about more and more people, including me, you know, I'm switched from milk to soy milk or almond milk. A lot of concerns being raised about meat consumption and what that might mean to people in you know, later in their lives. What do you see happening out there when it comes to how Americans are changing at the marketplace?
It's changing rapidly. It's small but growing, I think I would say, for changes in the dairy products that are from traditional dairy products to, like you mentioned, soy milk, almond milk, even oat milk now. And it's also changing in terms of how we consume our protein. The protein alternatives to a hamburger are flourishing. They're growing at a rate of 20% a year from a very small base right now.
Right.
So I think we've passed the point where if you don't want to consume traditional protein from an animal, you have to endure something made of soy that's not very tasteful. And we've transitioned to something that's different protein alternatives that are much more acceptable to many consumers. And I think you're seeing that dynamic play out. And like I said, it's a small share of the total pie, but it's growing rapidly right now. And it's certainly the growth area that's got the attention of restaurants, and it's got the attention of food manufacturers too. How do we participate in this new demand that mm-hmm. we're seeing out there?
Bill, how is the average dairy farmer, the average cattle rancher adjusting to these trends, which you say are, again, a small slice of the marketplace, but clearly a growing segment of what's going on out there?
Well, sure. Jonathan mentioned that it's a long cycle. It's actually over 2 years from the day you decreed you want less beef till there actually is less beef on the market. So it's a very slow dynamic for the cattle industry. Same for the dairy industry. Once you've built a dairy barn and have a system set up and dairy cows are producing milk for you, it takes some time for there to be attrition in the industry where participants leave. So it takes a long time before for these players in the market to adjust. And it becomes very difficult for livestock producers because pretty much the industry's got it set in stone to some degree how much production there's going to be in the next 6 or 12 months. I guess the analogy I would think of, if you want to visualize it, it's Lucy and Ethel at the candy factory trying to take care of all the candy that's coming down the line, and there's no way to slow it down for at least an extended period of time.
Yeah. So, Jonathan, is there any panic out there that there's too much meat and poultry on the market? Is that happening or not?
Not yet. Not yet. This is a story that kind of came out of some hunches and some asking around, and there's definitely mild concern. But again, because I really don't think that until it starts hitting people in the pocketbook, until companies are to the point where the supply-demand differential or the tariff issue, or like the USDA bought a whole bunch of food to meat and cheese and dairy to donate to food banks. It's when those things stop and the industry is actually caught in a negative financial position, that's when people will start panicking and get serious about mm-hmm. it. But until then, I don't see it. And I think Bill's much more qualified to talk about that than I am. But at least in my reporting and what I found, I didn't get a sense of panic. I got more of a sense of, yeah, it might be something, but we'll see.
Bill, you're not seeing panic out there, it doesn't sound like.
No, we've seen some aberrations in the market, but certainly not panic. I would say that the wholesale price of chicken breast last fall, and we're really not clear why, but it reached record lows. That doesn't always translate to the consumer or to the grocery store level, but it reached extraordinarily low levels where the demand was not picking it up, and the market has to clear every day. So the function of prices is to make sure there's some place for the meat that's produced today to go, because there's going to be more coming tomorrow.
Right.
And so whether that's to discount it to somebody you know that would be willing to move it to their grocery store, or to put it into cold storage, which was Jonathan's story here, and start building those. That's the function of prices, and I think the buildup in stocks in the cold storage facilities is a reflection of that.
Right. Jonathan, I got 30 seconds left here. Food bank managers, meantime, they're jumping up and down here. Tell us why.
They're thrilled because the biggest problem that any food bank has is getting donations of perishable stuff. You always hear about canned food drive and, boxes of food. That's the thing that people donate. They need cash to buy perishables. So when they get perishables like meat, cheese, dairy, they love it because it means they have cash for other things to help serve people.
That's Jonathan Aull. He's a reporter for Harvest Public Media. You can see his work there. Bill Lapp joined us today. He's president of Advanced Economic Solutions up in Omaha. Gentlemen, thank you both very much. I sure appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to switch gears and talk about the National Women's Conference of 1977. Yes, this is ancient history, but it changed our politics in ways that still reverberate today. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the program, we learned why Kansas City's oldest independent movie theater is closing its doors. You can hear my conversation with the owner of the Tivoli at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow on the show, I'm going to learn a new mantra, outer order, inner calm, with author Gretchen Rubin. She's going to help me declutter my lifestyle, and you won't want to miss it. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up-to-Date. Well, the National Women's Conference in 1977 was designed to bring America's women together to determine what the government could do to improve their lives. But that four-day conference wound up provoking a bitter debate between feminists and conservative women activists over abortion, gay rights, the ERA, and other issues. Some say the roots of the huge political divide in this country today were planted at that conference down in Houston. With us to look back on this event is Marjorie Sproul. She's a distinguished professor emerita of the University of South Carolina and author of Divided We Stand, The Battle Over Women's Rights and Family Values That Polarized American Politics. Professor, it's nice to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Looking back on it now, this conference ranks as this pivotal moment in our political history. Why isn't it better remembered today?
A good question, one I've asked myself a lot as I've been working on this, because it was astonishingly well known and highly publicized at the time. And now it seems like it's only the people who participated in it who seem to, although I think that's changing. Frankly, I hope to change that through the book.
Yeah, you know, I've covered politics for many years in my career, and I was reading about this conference last night and thinking to myself, why didn't I know more about this? This was a big deal. It involved the Missourian, Phyllis Schlafly, and all kinds of local connections here.
Yeah, and I look back on it and I think, where was I in 1977? I had to stop and think during the summer when the meetings were going on that were so hot. I was in Spain. During the fall, I was in my first semester of graduate school at the University of Virginia.
So you missed it too.
I missed it too. But the main thing, I didn't just miss it. I missed knowing about it.
Mm.
And that really amazes me because I'm usually paying attention.
You know, there was a time when, you know, both major political parties in this country supported the women's movement. What had that movement accomplished by 1977, the year when this conference took place?
Yeah, interestingly, the early 70s were a time when there was a lot of support for the women's movement, and until 1972, very little organized opposition.
Hmm.
Those early 70s, you know, both political parties were on board. There were feminists in each party who were working hard and working together through the National Women's Political Caucus. Even Richard Nixon, whom Bella Abzug famously called America's number one chauvinist pig, he didn't care much for feminism, but he was supporting it because he thought that's what women wanted. Congress was passing one bill after another, and the Supreme Court, of course, made a number of very important decisions that affected women's lives.
But this conference came along and changed much of that. How did the conference come about? Why did it happen?
Well, the conference is a direct result of the fact that there was this across-the-board support for the women's movement in the early 70s. If there had been a vote in Congress in the year it actually happened, it probably wouldn't have gotten approved because things had already started to change. But it came about as a result of the UN having a major international all-out effort to try to improve women's lives around the world. And they proclaimed that 1975 to 85 would be the decade for women.
Hmm.
And there was a major conference in Mexico City that they sponsored in 1975 that in which all the delegates from around the world came up with what they call the World Plan of Action. So it was women who had been at that meeting, most notably Congresswoman Bella Abzug, mm-hmm. and others, Patsy Mink of Hawaii, who said, we need to have an opportunity to produce a national plan of action, but we want there to be widespread engagement in the process. And so they were the ones that proposed to Congress that they have this series of conferences. And there was a state meeting in each state where every person who was 18 and older and a citizen could come together, debate the issues, and vote on resolutions. Wow. And delegates to go on to Houston, where there they voted on the final national plan.
And Congress actually mm-hmm. appropriated something like $5 million
yes.
to put the Houston conference on, and that's it wasn't right. even a close vote.
That's right, and Phyllis Schlafly called it federally funded feminism. She also called it a federally funded festival for frustrated feminists. She was really big on alliteration.
That's what she did. And the goals of the conference were to do what? What did they want to achieve?
They wanted to vote on a set of planks, of recommendations to send to President Carter and Congress. And under that congressional mandate, he had something like 90 days to respond as to how they were going to implement it. It had to be taken very seriously mm-hmm. by the president.
Does anything like a national women's conference take place today? I don't think so, does it?
No, in fact, it never did before either. So it was truly a unique event in American history.
Well, and speaking of that, when it comes to the big names who were at that conference, there were a whole host of them. People like who?
Well, three first ladies, for instance, representing both parties. You had Lady Bird Johnson, you had Betty Ford, and then the current first lady, Rosalynn Carter. That made a big splash, the fact that they were all there on stage together endorsing the Equal Rights Amendment and the goals of this conference. And you had women who were famous in nearly every field. Like Margaret Mead, for example, from academia. You had Maya Angelou, mm-hmm. who was already very famous at that point as a writer and an actress.
Coretta Scott King. Gloria Steinem, of course. Billie Jean King. Alan Alda, very famously early feminist, was there.
He was a big supporter of the women's rights movement during that time. And he had served on the presidentially appointed commission on the observance of International Women's Year and headed up the committee that worked for the Equal Rights Amendment.
We're talking about the resounding impact of the 1977 National Women's Conference with Professor Marjorie Sproul, who will deliver the Women's Rights, Family Values, and the Polarization of American Politics lecture tonight at 6:30 at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. You can RSVP at kclibrary.org. So how did things turn contentious? What happened?
Well, between the time that Congress voted on it and 1977, when they actually happened, had to be delayed till after the election, mm-hmm. The fighting about the Equal Rights Amendment and about abortion had really heated up. And so in 1977, as these state meetings got started, conservatives began to organize quietly to challenge the feminists for control of them. And so they started urging, they formed an organization encouraged conservatives to attend. They worked together with churches that had been their allies in the anti-ERA fight. Mormons were very much opposed to the Equal Rights Amendment because the church had declared it a moral issue that mm-hmm. every member must oppose. So the churches were working together with the Stop ERA, the Eagle Forum, and others to get women there in large numbers. Sometimes the parking lots at these things will be full of church buses.
Hmm. One of the key players here, a Missourian named Phyllis Schlafly. Who was she? She just died a couple of years ago.
Yes, she died during the 2016 campaign, and it should be known that she played a major role in having Donald Trump get the endorsement of the Christian right and helping him gain the nomination.
Donald Trump called Phyllis Schlafly a hero.
Yes, and he's tried to sort of position himself as taking up her cause after her death. Mm-hmm. Schlafly had been a fixture in American politics for a long time, and even before 1972, she had played a major role in helping Barry Goldwater be nominated. She wrote a very famous book called A Choice, Not an Echo, that she self-published and circulated all through the party, and it made a big difference there. But then she was kind of getting paid back from that after his candidacy crashed and there was a landslide against it. So she had kind of gotten sidelined by the progressive and us who were controlling the party at that time, like Rockefeller. And she had been absorbed very much in national defense issues. She was staunch anti-communist and was writing books about that. So she hadn't really come out on the ERA until after, right at the verge of its being released by Congress to the states.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was encouraged by other women, conservative women who were part of her circle, to look at it. And she didn't like what she saw. And it's also possible she saw an opportunity for massive grassroots organizing. And so she wrote a piece that came out against the ERA that was in her monthly newsletter, the Phyllis Schlafly Report.
What was her issue with the ERA?
Well, the main gist of it was that she believed that the American woman whom she saw as the American housewife was living the life, had achieved the American dream, that it had taken a long time to get men to be in harness and supporting families and treating women with respect, and that now and putting them on a pedestal, and that now women were going to be giving away rights, and that the feminist, through the Equal Rights Amendment and demanding that women be treated the same as men, were trying to create some unisex society in which women would lose more than they gained.
So she was satisfied with how things were at the time.
Yes, and you know, for someone like herself, who was happily married to a wealthy man and had a very good life, and also he supported her in being active in politics and everything. She was leading a good life. But, of course, it wasn't the same for every woman in the country. And a lot of women wouldn't care for her particular lifestyle either. That was really beside the point.
Right.
The point was that a lot of the laws and policies about affecting women and families at that time were very outdated. They did not correspond very well at all to the way that people were actually living their lives. And feminists were pushing hard to have, that's basically what the movement was about at that time, was having our laws and policies revised and updated for the way people were actually living at the time.
So Congress passed the ERA. The final step to get it into the Constitution was a vote by the states. And to bring this home here, there was a gigantic fight here in Missouri, led by Harriet Woods, who would go on to become lieutenant governor, almost became a U.S. senator, and Phyllis Schlafly, who mounted the opposition right here in Missouri, which never passed the ERA.
That's right. It's very interesting that if you compare it to the 19th Amendment for women to get the vote back in 1920, all across the nation, they ratified it except in the South. And a few southern states broke ranks and it was ratified. In the case of the Equal Rights Amendment, you have almost the entire South, with the exception of Texas, not ratifying. But what also happens that kills it is you have three Mormon dominated states in the West, and then you have Phyllis Schlafly's two home states, mm-hmm. Missouri and Illinois.
Mm-hmm. You know, you've said that there were more issues these two sides could have agreed on than disagreed on, but there were two issues that you say are both loaded with religious and moral significance, and that made both sides far less willing to compromise. Those two issues were abortion and LGBTQ rights, right?
Yes, those seem to be hot button issues about which people disagreed strongly, didn't believe should compromise on.
Yeah. You've also said that the conservative movement that Phyllis Schlafly led succeeded in demonizing feminism as a term, as a movement, as a word. Tell us about that, because that really even hasn't bounced back today.
Yeah. One thing that really comes through in my book is that feminism was a diverse movement that had its own right and left, moderates and radicals and everybody in between. But Schlafly successfully presented it to her people who were her supporters as if it was only a strongly radical movement that just wanted to sweep away all cherished institutions and transform lives completely. And here she is doing this while people like Rosalynn Carter and Betty Ford are on the stage at the conference that she's protesting. But it was a tactic that was very effective. You just present the people who disagree with you as all extremist, mm-hmm. while you claim to be reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But she demonized them very successfully, and that had a huge effect. So for many years afterwards, a lot of goals of the feminist movement continued to be realized while many people were avoiding the term and not wanting to call themselves that for fear of being considered really radical. She also managed to brand feminists as man-haters, when in fact, not only do most feminists not hate men, a lot of feminists are men. But the way she presented it was, worked.
So where do you see the current generation of younger women? Because there was this push towards the conservative for so many years. Do you see signs of pushback from the current younger generation?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it is astounding how activated the young women are today, joining a lot of older feminists who really never gave up and never stopped. And kept on pushing and accomplishing a great deal. I never believed that the feminist movement failed. A lot of people said that because the ERA did, that the whole thing failed, which is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
It's been the women's movement changed America, and it never really changed back. But in recent years, there's some threats to that. And I think that what happened is that we're seeing today the results of the election of a avowedly anti-feminist man against a feminist woman and a lot of young women who are seeing rights that they thought were long since theirs and settled law now being challenged.
Marjorie Sproul's book, Divided We Stand, A Battle Over Women's Rights and Family Values That Polarized American Politics. Again, she speaks at 6:30 this evening at the Plaza Branch of a Kansas City Public Library. More information, kclibrary.org. Marjorie, what a pleasure to have you here. Thanks for taking
some time. Thanks, I enjoyed it very much.
Coming up, Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Well, look who's here, Brian McTavish, to talk about some neat stuff to do on your upcoming weekend. Thank goodness the weekend's almost here. Welcome back. How are you?
We got a lot of neat stuff to
nice
chat
to see
about
you.
Here, okay?
Yes.
Nice to see you
Let's
as
kick
well.
It off with Record Store Day 2019.
Yes, yes. These are the records, so we had to play the records for Record Store Day. This one goes back to Hold On To Your Tights. 1978 or 9?
Yes.
I don't remember exactly on purpose because it's shocking when I know just exactly how much time has passed. So,
yes.
Record Store Day 2019. It's a hit with people who seek out and want to find special vinyl releases
yes.
on this very special day, Saturday, all day, at least 7 local record stores. Cool. Maybe you'll pick up something collectible that makes you happy. Have you been to Record Store Day?
No.
You will.
I will.
You will.
I don't do the vinyl thing, but I need to go.
Okay,
yeah.
Real quick, just go downtown to the Crossroads. There's a lot of stores,
yes.
but just go down to the Crossroads. They're almost across the street from each other. There's,
Yeah.
Now I'm blanking.
Well, yeah, I know which ones you're talking about.
Josie Records.
Yes.
And then the small little beautiful
yes.
one, Revolution Records.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, anyway, but wherever you might go, even if you don't really care what's in the grooves, and I feel sorry for you if you do, but you can frame these as works of art, right?
That's right.
These album covers. You can get into these
artists.
Can't
do that with CDs.
Well, you could, but you'd get funny looks.
Yeah.
Well, you could get more up on the wall that way, like a grid of music. Or
yeah.
remember liner notes?
Yes.
Now they're in the booklet.
Yes.
And now they're not
you
even.
You can't read them. They're too small.
Well, who gets the booklet?
Yeah.
Half of the people listening don't even play CDs anymore, right?
I know.
So anyway, enjoy yourself. Keep the collection going or start it anew this Saturday at Record Store Day.
Who's going to become the next champion?
We'll leave that to you. Aren't you the arbiter of that sort of thing?
We'll leave that to the people playing soccer this weekend,
yes.
I think. Yes.
Yes. A couple of sporting events. First, there's the KC Champions Cup 2019. It's presented by the Heartland Soccer Association. It's the 12th annual Midwest Soccer Tournament for who else but girls and boys of various ages and skill levels. It's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. You can go watch for free at two locations. One, Shields Overland Park Soccer Complex, or perhaps the Olathe Soccer Complex. Hmm. And we have another sporting event this weekend. Actually,
yes.
the Royals are going to start playing the Mariners in less than half an hour.
The who?
The Mariners?
No,
the Royals?
Yeah.
It's already done for you.
Yeah,
it's already done for you.
I love the team.
Yeah.
I like the game, but bad start.
Well, it's all but a cosmic lock that the Royals don't have what it takes to make the playoffs this season. But I say, so what? They're still our boys in blue. And as the late, great Kansas City Monarch player, manager, and KC Royal scout Buck O'Neill used to say whenever he got the chance, keep swinging. And that's what the Royals have to do, and that's what the fans have to do. They play the Cleveland Indians, and there's all sorts of fun promotions, including Sunday, Game of Thrones Day at the K.
Wow.
You might be able to take home a dragon bobblehead.
Be sure to see Brian's 7 spring things to do for families this weekend at kcur.org. Whatever happened to whatever did happen to fun?
No. I was going to ask you the same question.
I asked the questions here. You answered the questions.
Well, you do remind me of that too often.
Yes, yeah.
Well, whatever happened to fun? Well, I'll tell you where you can find it. Worlds of Fun. How easy is that?
It's opening up this weekend.
Opening weekend. Your favorite thrill ride awaits. They're open, first time to get on the Timberwolf or any number
yes.
of other illness-inducing
yes.
thrill machines.
Yes.
10 to 10 Saturday, 10 to 7 Sunday at Worlds of Fun. Are you a roller coaster fan?
Love them.
I hate them.
Do you?
But
love them.
What I like to do is, we go, you get on there, and I say, hey, you go up there. I'm just going to have some cotton candy and a hot dog and a couple of Cokes.
I'll wave at you.
All the things that you should not have in your stomach when you
get don't do that.
On the Mamba, the Patriot, the Prowler, the Timberwolf. Good luck. Those with the nerve, Saturday and Sunday at Worlds of Fun.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Like that music. Aaron Copland.
Yeah.
By the way.
Okay. Kansas City
Appalachian
Symphony.
Spring.
Well, I think you've said it all now. What else? What's left for me to muse on?
Not much.
How about this? No, you're right. Well, we'll work on that later. Spring into classical music. That's what you didn't say. With Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring and other life-affirming selections from our own Kansas City Symphony and their conductor, Michael Stern. Question. How will you feel afterward? sprung.
Yes.
You'll feel sprung because this is Appalachian Spring. Now, also, Kansas City Symphony for the little kiddies, they're putting on their petite performances, big and small, because you can't start musical appreciation too early. Gather up those little ones or go borrow some and get down to the KC Symphony's petite performances, big and small concerts. They're Saturday, 9:30, 10:30, and 11:30. That's in the morning on Saturday. Get up and do it. Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. There's a petting zoo for instruments, and they'll hear music and talk about music and be pleased by it, I'm sure.
And finally today.
Go, 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 gorilla, go, now go.
What do we have here?
April.
April.
As in ape.
Yeah.
April.
Oh.
Get it?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, that's not mine. That's the Zeus copy person.
There you go.
But
there
I mean, that's why they make the big bucks. April, celebrating apes. Zookeepers will tell it like it is about gorillas and orangutans and chips and gibbons. It all happens from 10:30 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon, Saturday and Sunday at the Kansas City Zoo. Gorillas are my favorite, so I'll be there from, well, I'll be there in spirit, if not there, perhaps, from 11 to 1:30. That's where you get everything you need to know about the gorilla thing going on at the zoo.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. That's Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Thank you, sir.
See you out there.
And breaking news this hour, a major development in the race for Kansas City mayor. A Lawrence prosecutor has dropped DUI charges against Kansas City Councilman Quentin Lucas, one of the two finalists in the race for mayor against Jolie Justice. That charge perhaps hanging over his head just a little bit. This is the deal where he was sitting in his car over in Lawrence and then arrested and charged with DUI. That charge now has been dropped by a Lawrence prosecutor. So that news breaking this hour. Tomorrow on the show, just in time for a little spring cleaning, lifestyle author Gretchen Rubin shares some sensible tips for decluttering, which I'm all for, in achieving outer order and inner calm. Yesterday in the show, the owner of the Tivoli discussed why he's closing the curtain on Kansas City's oldest independent movie theater. You can hear that in other previous episodes. You'll find them at kcur.org/uptodate. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.